As a German, it's difficult to break rules, but in Berlin, it's much easier. The most important thing for me, what is Berlin about, is freedom, the feeling of freedom. In Berlin, you can be who you want to be. You can do what you want to do. Berlin is diverse. And what shaped Koda to the restaurant, what is today, it's not just me or like Germans. It's like the multicultural inhabitants in Berlin. And the guests, they come to Berlin because they want to experience Berlin as a city. And they see such a interesting and different restaurant concept. And then they say, oh, wow, we're in Berlin, then we need to go to Koda because this is something we haven't seen before and that doesn't exist somewhere else.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. In this season, we're talking about guts. And today, we'll talk about the daring guts to revolutionize dessert, the magic behind becoming the master of sweets, and the bold decision of taking sugar off the established pedestal of pastries. And guess with whom we'll be talking?
Our guest today is René Franck, one of the most renowned pastry chefs in the world. He has been awarded the esteemed title of Pâtissier of the Year on four occasions, in 2013, 2016, 2019, and 2020. This recognition has been bestowed upon him by a number of esteemed organizations, including Go and Mio and Rolling Pin. A pioneer in the world of patisserie, in 2022, René was named World's Best Pastry Chef. And in 2024, his restaurant Koda was ranked 62nd by the world's 50 best restaurants list. He's the genius behind Koda in Berlin, Germany's inaugural dessert-inspired restaurant with two Michelin stars. Known for pushing the boundaries of traditional desserts combined with savory ingredients, he has crafted a unique dining experience that elevates the traditional sweet course into a full 15 courses dinner menu between sweet and savory, showcasing natural sweetness from fruit and vegetables, high quality organic and sustainable products, and a commitment to avoiding artificial and industrial ingredients or refined sugar. René's remarkable journey began with a gold medal at the 2005 World Skills Competition in Helsinki, showcasing his early promise, leading him to a career path of influential roles, including junior pastry chef at Zirbelstube in Stuttgart, and stints at Oriol Balaguer in Barcelona and Akelare in San Sebastian, both three Michelin starred. In 2012, as head pastry chef at La Vie in Osnabrück, his innovation helped the restaurant secure its third Michelin star. A graduate from Centre de Formation Alain Ducasse in Paris and the Culinary Institute of America in New York and Napa Valley, he further refined his craft at Lampin's in Switzerland and Restaurant Georges Blanc in France, and gained further international experience at Nihon Ryori Ryogin and Kikinoi in Japan.
Chef René Franck, I'm very, very excited to have you at the studio today. Thank you very much for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me and thanks so much for the invitation.
In music, coda is a concluding section of a composition or movement, typically bringing the piece to an end. In Germany, there is a saying that goes, first the work, then the pleasure. Of course, food is mostly about pleasure, but dessert is a closing ultimate indulgence. And as a German, then it's not easy to break a rule. But you did just that. You created a concept for your restaurant, Koda, where 15 plates are built around dessert. And I would love if you could talk about this concept and how it has evolved since its beginning.
Yeah, that's true. As a German, it's difficult to break rules. But in Berlin, it's much easier. I've just been 2 weeks ago in Munich. And I think, like, if you compare Munich and Berlin, it's, those two cities are so different. And I grew up in the south of Germany, and I've chosen Berlin as my hometown, as a place for Coda, because Berlin is so diverse and open-minded. So for me as a German, in Berlin, it's like everything very different. So there's a lot of rules are broken or get broken in Berlin. But the thing is, like, Coda comes from Italian music language, and we actually choose this name because we knew at the beginning, which was like 8 years ago when we opened Coda as a dessert bar, that Coda is about desserts, but we didn't know in which direction we're going to go. And the traditional dessert is like the last part of the menu. This is how we came to the name. And then we thought, okay, we're just going to work on the dessert and we see where we're going. So first we refined dessert, but then we thought, okay, there is a request to have dessert for dinner. And this is how we then came up and developed the concept of having dessert for dinner. But this was actually not the idea. And it was not the idea to change the perception of dessert that much.
Throughout this season, we have talked a lot about sugar. So much so that I would say it has become the villain of the piece. Today, I wanted to talk about the sweet part of sugar, the one that builds up in the fun memories. And oh my, how many of those we have. René, what childhood memories does the man who has repeatedly been voted the world's best pastry chef draw on to create the amazing dishes for which he's so well known today?
Yeah, I think dessert and pastry is the most emotional part of a menu and of food, in my opinion. And this, of course, connects you always to your childhood. And as a kid, I always loved sweet things and pastry. And I think that's also very important, how your relation is to food is about what you experience as a kid. So when I grew up, kitchen was the place in the whole house where everything happens. I mean, where we did the planning already in the morning, what we have for lunch and for dinner, where everybody came together, where we discussed about things, about positive things, but also about negative things on the, it happened everything on the dining table. And when I was bored or I wasn't happy, I went to the kitchen because there was always like somebody. So it was like a good place to experience something or to meet somebody. My family, like everybody was cooking or baking. My father is a miller, my grandfather was a miller. And baking was like a big thing at home. Always not necessarily sweet baking, also like bread baking. Yeah. So this is, for me, always the kitchen is a magical place. All you haters can stay mad at me. From a kid to a man, from a man to a star.
Bike to a minivan to a supercar. I'm curious, what is it that you chat about in your kitchen besides planning and cooking nowadays?
Today, for me, the kitchen is, I mean, I have a big team and a very good team, so unfortunately I don't work that much anymore right in my kitchen. But for me, a kitchen still has is a magical place and a very emotional place.
Nowadays, high cuisine and nouvelle cuisine kitchens are turned into labs, which is absolutely perfect with the times we are living in. But I love that you're saying that it's also like a meeting point, still a meeting point, and it's still very human.
Yes, yeah. I think this is also food connects everybody. And this is also, I was taught as a kid that the time of the day where you have dinner, especially, is the time where everybody gets together. And my father said, this is important because this is the only time where we really sit at least half an hour together and we can discuss about everything what's happening. And I still keep this today with my staff. So when we have the food, which we have every day, exactly at 5:40, which is, I think, very German. but we're very strict on that. And this is also the time where everybody sits together. And it's interesting also to see that, I mean, some know this kind of culture, but for some, they didn't grow up with this sitting together on the table and having a meal together.
So you're growing a family,
yes,
in your
exactly,
kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
As you may have noticed, you have a beautiful lady sitting by your side. She's well-known Dutch interior designer, Petra van Velen, my co-host for season one, Colors. And she has just arrived from Amsterdam, and I'm sure she's really looking forward to talking to you today. Petrov and Phelan, good morning.
Good morning, Ceci. Good morning, Rene. Hi. Such a pleasure to be here and a big honor to join this podcast with Rene. And I was really touched by what you were saying about the kitchen and your memories, that the kitchen is such a social place to connect to your family and an emotional place. And that reminds me of an animated movie, Ratatouille. It's about the rat, Remy, who happened to be passionate about eating, and he is a talented chef and has the dream to become a chef, but his father wouldn't allow him, but he is persistent. And the insane critical reviewer, Anton Ego, ends the film with a fantastic review. I quote, "Last night, I experienced something new, an extraordinary meal from a singularly unexpected source. To say that both the meal and its maker have challenged my preconceptions about fine cooking is a gross understatement. They have rocked me to my core. In the past, I have made no secret of my disdain for Chef Gusteau's famous motto, anyone can cook. But I realize only now do I truly understand what he meant. Not everyone can become a great artist, but a great artist can come from anywhere." And in this movie, the late chef Gusteau's motto is anyone can cook. René?
Yeah, I think also everyone can cook. And I think the most important thing for a chef is passion. Passion about what you do. And of course, having the access to great produce, to good ingredients. And if you're motivated to eat, you always would spend time to find food, to research for it, and to prepare it. So of course, it requires to become a cook, it requires some passion. Because if you don't allow yourself to spend the time in the kitchen to prepare something, then you cannot cook something properly. So I would say passion and good ingredients is the key. Yeah, yeah. And definitely, so I mean, I know a lot of chefs. By myself, also started cooking when I was 16. I've been working the first time in a kitchen when I was 13. I needed to do that because I was so passionate about it. But I think a lot of chefs start very early and work like years in the kitchen and maybe lose their passion. And always like somebody who crosses paths and brings a more passion with him, maybe is sometimes the better cook than somebody who has like years experience. Yeah.
So all this season long, as I've said, scientists, doctors, academics, everyone has been talking about how harmful refined sugar and also alternative sweeteners are to our bodies, our minds and our emotions. And how does it link not only to obesity, diabetes or cognitive impairment, but also to mental health and even criminal behavior. But René, as a pastry chef, and not just any pastry chef, but one of the best in the world, you have not lost faith in what I would say is the most tempting of all courses in a meal. And you have taken it to the next level. You have stripped dessert of its most characteristic garb, named sugar, milk, white flour, and sometimes even butter. Please tell us about your strong belief in dessert and how have you been able to take dessert to the next level by removing the ingredients that only yesterday were considered to be key.
So the thing is, I'm a pastry chef, but my background is being a chef. And this is how I spend also most of my time working in kitchens. And as a chef, you learn to taste food and to think about maybe in here I need a little bit more salt, a little bit more acidity, maybe need some sweetness. So about a balance in food. And this is also how I'm trained to always like make very balanced food. And for me, pastry was always like very unbalanced, very heavy. Excessive use of like eggs, milk products, like dairy products in general, and flour. And when we started Codam, first we worked, I mean, we had good ingredients, but we worked with white sugar and all those ingredients. It's just when we got the idea to offer a tasting menu, which is about dessert dining, so dinner for desserts. And I knew that one day we need to make the decision what we want to do with Coda. Do we want to keep on serving dessert as a dessert, or do we want to serve a tasting menu with desserts? One day we want to keep on serving dessert for dinner. And then nobody came anymore. The guests didn't understand. Why should you eat at 6 o'clock in the evening, six courses for dinner? And then, like dessert. And then I thought, okay, we need maybe a Michelin star. And to gain a Michelin star, I knew from my experience, I spent my whole life in Michelin star restaurants, you need proper ingredients. and of course, no industrial processed ingredients. You don't want to use MSG in food. And this is what, where I said we need to ban white sugar, because this is like after water and salt, the cheapest ingredients what you can have in food. And this is how this idea got created. And since that, I have kind of a hate-love relationship with sugar. And since that, we decided to ban all industrial processed ingredients, which is also a lot of stabilizers, gelatin, and all these ingredients. But it was never really like the concept and the idea of the beginning. And then I got more into that and I realized what white sugar actually is. And I like to compare it with MSG. You know, you can cook food and you can add MSG to cheap ingredients. Or you can have like good ingredients and use them the way how you can create umami in the food. And this is also the same way with you can have sweetness in food by adding white sugar or by using good ingredients which have a naturally occurring sweetness.
But the next question is related to this revolutionary way of thinking about dessert in relation to appetite, and about convincing people about your vision. This is Dr. Elsa Richardson, cultural historian of health, medicine and psychology, with a particular interest in the history of vegetarianism and the science of nutrition.
Hello, my name is Elsa Richardson and I have a question for Chef René Frank. In the course of researching my book, Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut, I became interested in the cultural meanings we attach to the idea of appetite and with how these meanings have shifted over time. So the philosopher Plato, for example, associated the gut with our baser appetites, namely lust, and placed these in opposition to the rational work of the mind. While in 18th century France, it was widely accepted that to be a man of learning was also to be a man of good taste and to be well acquainted with the pleasures of the table. Today, we tend to exclude puddings, pastries, and sweets from what is considered to be a healthy appetite. These are usually dismissed as an indulgence or perhaps even as a kind of childish excess. And I wondered, as someone who has dedicated his life to pastry, if you have any thoughts on our tendency to dismiss or disavow dessert, and what this might reveal of our broader attitudes towards appetite.
Yes, it's a very interesting question. Sugar makes people addicted to it. I think there's a big role in your relationship to something sweet when you're a kid. If you learn how to regulate your appetite as a kid, or if you just have like excess all the time to anything sweet. And this is something also that you keep when you're adult. And it's very, very difficult to say no to something sweet when you never said no, or you always had the access to sweet things as a kid. And I think sweets are very, very emotional. It's also something what you use for a compensation of a stress level, that you eat a higher amount of sugar. So it really depends that some guests, they tend to eat something sweet just because they have a stressful feeling and they see that there is the compensation. Others learn how to compensate their stress level by doing sports or even by drinking alcohol or maybe consuming drugs. There's probably something sweet a better way, but it's different kinds of compensations.
In this season, we've talked before about how dark chocolate helps the gut microbiome because it contains polyphenols and biotic fibers present in cocoa, which help good bacteria in the gut to grow, reducing inflammation, and among other things, how it also stimulates the production of serotonin, which makes us feel better and happier. The story of chocolate dates back thousands of years to the ancient civilizations of Mesoamerica, where the Olmecs, Mayans, and Aztecs were among the first to discover the cacao plant. Well, I think the following story is definitely worth hearing.
Legend has it that when Cortes and his men arrived in the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan in 1519, they were treated like royalty by the Emperor Moctezuma, who mistakenly believed that Cortes might be a returning god. As part of their lavish welcome, Moctezuma introduced the Spaniards to a sacred Aztec drink, Chocolatl, a bitter, frothy concoction made from crushed cocoa beans, chili peppers, and water. The Aztecs believed this drink had invigorating properties, and Moctezuma reportedly drank it by the gallon to boost his virility, claiming it gave him the stamina to keep up with his many wives. When Cortes and his men first tried the drink,
They were in for a shock. Expecting something luxurious like the wine they were accustomed to, they were instead greeted by the bitter, spicy taste of unsweetened cocoa. The soldiers struggled to hide their expressions of surprise and discomfort as they tried to down the unfamiliar beverage in front of their host. It is said that Cortez was not too impressed with the taste at first, but quickly realized the potential of this exotic cocoa, and when he wrote back to Spain, he claimed that chocolate was a divine drink that builds resistance and fights fatigue, although it is possible that he was just trying to disguise the drink's unpleasant taste. Once the Spaniards brought cocoa back to Europe, they wisely added sugar and spices, transforming the drink into the sweet, delicious hot chocolate that took the continent by storm. As for Moctezuma's claims of its invigorating effects, well, the Spanish might have exaggerated that part too. But thanks to this cultural misunderstanding, chocolate evolved into the beloved treat we enjoy today.
René Cora's signature dish is the chocolate caviar popsicle. And of course, the last course, the dessert, is all chocolate. Even the farewell delicious pralines are chocolate. And unlike Cortez, you do not use sugar to sweeten them. And tell us, please, about your fascination with chocolate, its texture and flavor, and the way you treat it in your menus.
So at Cora, since 5-6 years, we make our own chocolate. But the thing is, so everything what is sweet contains sugar. Yeah. Also, it's just that we don't use industrial processed white sugar, but of course we use sugar naturally occurred sweetness in ingredients. Yeah. So we make by scratch 100% cocoa paste in the restaurant with a stone grinder. What we also show you when you come to the restaurant, we take you to the kitchen at Cora as well. No? And this we use, and then we think about what kind of sweetener we use if we want to sweeten it. And the thing is that chocolate, same like bread, and there are not so many other things. There are some, but it's known always like industrial prepared. The thing is like bread was before an artisan thing and got like very industrial. Of course, you still have a lot of good bakeries, but chocolate was always industrial produced and got then artisan. So it's also very difficult to convince everybody with like the real taste of cacao, which has the bitterness and it has acidity, which gets mostly from like especially industrial producers balanced with a lot of sugar. Yeah. And then it varies also with the amount of how much cacao is inside. Yeah. I like to showcase the real taste of cacao, which is about the characteristic of the cocoa bean and the country of the origin. That's why we always see what kind of preparation do we have and what kind of sweetener do we use. Sometimes it's maybe some honey or even like the sweetness what we use from purple carrots combined with chocolate, what is very interesting. And like this, we prepare a dessert with chocolate.
I get very curious about this caviar popsicle.
But it is not caviar popsicle, it doesn't contain chocolate.
Oh, it does not? Yeah. Ah, okay.
No, this is like, well, it has like kind of a little coating around of white chocolate. What would you make by scratch? Caviar popsicle is one signature dish. But then on the end of the menu, you have like a chocolate dessert and then also some pralines.
Back to this signature dish, the caviar popsicle, for how many years on the menu?
We came up with this after COVID, so maybe, almost 3 years.
3 years?
Yeah.
So, must be very lekker, as we would say.
In Dutch,
yeah. How would you describe this dish if it was a person?
So, this dish is not sweet and not savory. So, it's something in between. It has no category. And if it's a person, it's not male and not female. So, I would describe it as non-binary.
Okay.
This is actually like, in general, our style right now, after 8 years at Cora, is also, we say, like, it's not dessert, it's like known court form, what we do. Yeah. Because, so the original idea to use caviar in a dessert was because chicken eggs are excessively used in pastry in general. I mean, caviar is not the same as a chicken egg, but I thought like, okay, let's use maybe some different kind of eggs. And this is how I thought, like, why not making something with fish egg? So usually eggs are used as a stabilizer. In this case, we use the caviar to get flavor, especially umami. Yeah. So it's ice cream of Jerusalem artichoke and vanilla. In the center, we have a ganache made of pica nuts. Then we have 12 grams of Osjetra caviar around. Then covered in a very, very thin layer of a pica nut, kind of a white chocolate. What you make, that's crunch, yeah. And when you eat it, it's really, I mean, you eat it like a popsicle. So the ice cream is frozen and super creamy, but the caviar is not frozen. So if you eat it and you think, I'm eating caviar, the taste is different because it's not how you used to eat caviar. If you think I'm eating a popsicle, it's very different because it's not how usually a popsicle tastes. Yeah. And this is why I would describe it kind of, it's very balanced. But it doesn't fit in any category.
So it's an intriguing balanced person.
Kind of, yes, yeah. So the thing is, I strive for balance in everything what I do. I don't want to say that I personally am very balanced, but I always like to have balance in everything. And this is also the caviar popsicle. You also can say it's like provocating, but I don't think in that case. Yeah. It depends if you say, yeah, I want to eat a popsicle. And then, like with chocolate and it's sweet and has a crust outside, then it's kind of provocating. Yeah.
It also sounds like an holistic experience.
Yes, it is. And the thing is, for all everything what we do at Coda, it's you need to sit down and just like be open to everything what's happening. And again, we're not a restaurant where you go because you say, oh, I have a craving for sugar now and I want to have like a lot of desserts. Yeah. This is not what Coda is about.
Flavor exists of taste and aroma or smell, and our sense of taste comes from these taste buds on our tongue, and it's like we can taste salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. So this reminds me of a friend who had to undergo a head surgery, and after that she lost one of her senses of smell, and that messed really up her appetite. So she can only taste sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami, but no other flavors. And her love for food is above average. And that makes it actually more painful. But she is very optimistic and she started to experiment with spices and combinations to vary her dining experience. And she says she eats with her eyes a lot and her memory recalls certain flavors from the past. So, for example, when she eats a raspberry, it tastes exactly as a strawberry for her. But with the vision and the structure of the fruit and the flavor in mind, she tastes a raspberry. So I'm curious if you are familiar with guests who lack a sense of smell and if you would be able to create like a dining experience that would enhance their taste and perhaps even have an explosion in the mouth effect.
Yes, I think an important thing about this is what you can imagine. And also if you have a lot of rememberings how things maybe tasted before you lost the taste and then you can remind it. So I think what also very important is, of course, the visual part. And also the textures, what you have in your mouth. And then the whole feeling, what you have in the guest room, also how you are treated from the service staff, how is the atmosphere, how is the interior design. And I think if you put the same energy in all these aspects, you can compensate the lack of taste in food, I think. It's also a big thing for me as a chef. I don't think that the flavor what I have on the plate is like 100% of the whole experience. This makes maybe 30, 40% because you're there for the food, but all the other things, especially texture, what you have, and also how you feel on the table, how you touch your glass, your cutlery and everything. This is also a huge part of the experience.
I went to Coda for dinner, and this is really what I experienced. A wonderful use of skill, using dessert techniques and textures, as you were mentioning. And also, I did have that experience of touching the glasses. They're not homogeneous. The staff is professional, yet very friendly, and the food, well, the food is obviously the star of the night. So we walk into a stunning minimalistic room with a perfect amount of light, and the place is absolutely buzzing. There's music in the kitchen, the bar is packed with people having a great time, all very unpretentious. And then we're shown to our table. We sit down, and our waitress comes over with a sort of industrial box on wheels. She opens this rolling cabinet and suddenly a world of light and flawless glasses appears before our eyes. It's incredible. She gives us a choice to drink And with this choice begins our coda journey.
Having an experience in a restaurant is a holistic experience. And this is not just like about the food. And mostly chefs, I mean, yes, as a head chef in the kitchen, responsible for the food. But as I'm the owner of the whole restaurant, I think about everything. Oliver, my business partner, did the whole interior design and we matched very well. And I think this is then really also for some guests, they don't have the taste or they're more focused maybe on visual things. They still can have a great experience.
Yeah, now that we're talking about imagination and creativity, one episode I really liked in this season was the Prometheus episode, in which Richard Martin, professor of classics at Stanford University, talked precisely about the spirit of Prometheus and creativity. And Renee, your creations are like little pieces of art, almost too beautiful to let it disappear so quickly in your mouth. So you mentioned you do not put anything on the plate just for the beauty. Every piece on the plate contributes to the taste of the dish, like you said. Huh? It's like the 30% food and the rest is everything else. So where do you get your inspiration from to design these beautiful, exquisite dishes?
Yes, so really the inspiration is that I try not to do things which I have seen somewhere, especially with the perception of how the plate looks like. So there is a classic presentation of desserts nowadays, which mostly contain a cannelle and maybe two other components and some herbs on the plate. So when somebody sees my creation, I don't want that you can tell immediately, oh, that's a dessert or that's a starter or this is a soup or something. That first it looks kind of mysterious. And for me, it's like we don't do something just to have it look nice. Of course, in food, there are a lot of things like garnishes or some herbs or flowers, even things like this chefs put on the plates. And how I got to this was also because everything what you put on a plate, which is not necessary, of course, is like food cost and costs additional money also to prepare it, to keep it, to buy it, of course. And we got all rid of that also for economy reasons. And this limits you also as a chef. So you need to have this, let's say, 3-4 components on the plate. You need to think how you arrange them, that it looks interesting. And this is also my dare to be different idea, where I want to have things different and that you don't know exactly when you see the creation, that you don't know immediately what it is.
And you're talking in a way about making a little system of doing things. And from this system and this creation process, there comes always a good menu. And an outstanding menu could be compared even to a beautiful choreography. But then you feel comfortable with that beautiful choreography. How do you realize that it's time to change it? And how do you avoid, that's very important, hanging onto a popular menu? How do you kick off the creative process of building one up?
So actually, we never change the whole menu in once. We always like change one or two dishes. There are also some signature dishes what we don't change so often. But otherwise, we work very much according to the season. And when the season is over, like we preserve also some fruits, like now we have like cherries, apricots, plums preserved. When these preserved chars are used, then we change a dish. But what I don't like to do is if I think I don't like a dish or my guests don't like a dish, to change it because of that. Then I always think like, okay, but I believe in the concept of the dish and I put it so much energy inside. So maybe if somebody doesn't like it, when it happens, you know, that guests prefer that dish and instead of another, but then I give it another chance and I work on it. This is something what I got inspired by working in Japan, to always like work on things, like to make things better, to make it with a better ingredients or a better preparation, or how you feel by yourself when you do this like improvement process, which Japanese call it like a kaizen. And this is something what we do since years in Koda, that we never take something off because it's not good enough, that we always like try to work on it.
I would love to ask you about 4 dishes of your current menu, which were handpicked by me after my experience when dining at Koda. And I would like to know what the story behind them is, or rather what story you're trying to tell through them. These were my 4 favorite dishes. First is the beefcake, sweet potato and almond.
Yeah, so that's a very, very simple preparation. So the idea was also there because we were looking for balance. Because mostly in every recipe, what you do in pastry dessert, there's like butter involved. I mean, it's not that we want to make it, let's say, completely without butter and we want to use some oil or something blend-based. It's just we want to use a different product, which gives a different flavor. And that's how we thought, like, why not using bone marrow? It's the same kind of fat, but it has a completely different flavor. Like butter contains 80% fat and 20% whey or water. So we just use the bone marrow as the 80% of the fat, and then we prepare this cake and we get sweetness and the structure from the sweet potato. So it's really kind of a cake, which tastes almost the direction of a cookie. Gives you a warm feeling because you get this kind of meaty taste from the bone marrow. So the inspiration also to use bone marrow is kind of in Iranian cuisine. You have sweet dishes with like bone marrow or with meat inside. And this is also where the inspiration comes from a little bit. So the story is really that we substitute butter, not with something plant-based, yeah, with the bone marrow, yeah, to give it more flavor. And of course, it's like it has some sweetness, especially from the sweet potato, but we want to have it balanced. And it's always, if you take something out of a recipe, let's say sugar, you need to substitute it with something. So the amount, we fill it up with a sweet potato, but not have the lack of sweetness. We want to put some flavor. And that's where we have then the flavor of the bone marrow.
Well, my second favorite dish was the rhubarb, estragon, rape honey.
So this is a combination of like cooked rhubarb, like poached rhubarb, and raw rhubarb. Yeah. The idea is also just like to show rhubarb in different textures, because rhubarb is mostly known as a like overcooked or as a jam, so very soft. So we want to show the structure of rhubarb, and it's actually a dessert more based on vegetable. Rhubarb is actually a vegetable combined with tarragon. Tarragon is maybe not something very known in desserts and pastry, but we did like kind of an ice cream with the tarragon, and then combined with a light mousse of yogurt.
And dear listener, I know the next dish will probably sound too simple, but believe me, it is not. It is presented as the purest of gems, and it tastes that way too. Even my youngest son, because we took a photograph and he saw it, he said, "I think that's where fairies lived in." You know, it's like a little fairy house. So that is the lettuce cucumber fresh cheese.
Okay. When I use something like lettuce or tomato or something, I always try to completely forget how these things are usually used. Like a lettuce, of course, you make a vinaigrette and you marinate it and you have it kind of a side salad. But I always think how a lettuce would be if it would have been always used in desserts and pastries. So we candied it. We made like a kind of a lettuce candy, which is the lettuce gets marinated in maple syrup, and then we put it on a round-shaped silicone mat, and then we dehydrate it. So we get like kind of a very, very thin crust. And it's like very simple, just like these two ingredients. So we have the lettuce candied in the maple syrup. And then to combine the sweetness, to give it a contrast, we have a pickled cucumber, which is like just like cucumber and salt in this pickled, which creates some umami and a little bit meatiness. And to give some freshness to it, we have some cottage cheese, which goes inside. So it's just like a few ingredients, and it's a sensation in the mouth because you have the saltiness from the pickled cucumber, the umami from the fermented pickled cucumber, combined with the sweetness of the lettuce. It almost tastes a little bit like nori seaweed. So I call it the Brandenburg nori.
And to the eye, it's also magical. And the last one, last but not least, as they always say, the raclette waffle, kimchi yogurt. Of course.
Yeah. So this is a dish, so waffle, it looks like a real waffle. And a waffle is always something, of course, heavy and a little bit fatty and very sweet. But we make it completely on the savory side. And as cheese, especially in the French cuisine, cheese is on the same level as dessert. And for us, cheese is important for the whole dinner menu, also to deliver umami. We created a very, very super light waffle with this savory batter, made with the rice flour and some corn flour. And inside we have a slice of a raclette cheese. It's kind of, from flavor-wise, a very ordinary dish, but there's just like a few seconds between genius and cheese toast.
Yeah, it's like a little bit the ratatouille last scene when he goes back to his childhood and like vroom.
Yeah.
You know.
And then also to make it a bit more interesting, we combine it with some dehydrated kimchi, yeah, to give it us a little bit, again, a little bit more umami and also some spiciness to it, a little complexity. And with a little dot of a fresh natural yogurt, yeah, to give some freshness to it. So you have this, and this is also something, you cannot eat this cheese waffle with cutlery. You need to use your hands. And sometimes guests think, oh, I'm at a Michelin star restaurant, I cannot use my hands. Of course, it's about having fun. And when you take this waffle and you break it apart and then you see this cheese strings, and this just like gives you a very, very homey and comfortable feeling. So this is, flavor-wise, it's a malted cheese, which is raclette all about, but it's just an experience, and it just gives you such a comfortable feeling, which is very interesting to see also the reaction of the guests, what happens to them when they eat this and the fun what you have with it.
When we talk about the creative process and inspiration, artists are said to experience inspiration coming from an external force and then being only vectors or translators of that force. And that comes very often. And Petra, you were mentioning Professor Richard Martin, who is one of the foremost Greek mythology scholars. Let's hear him, and also let's hear internationally acclaimed poet Jennifer Clement talk about the muse as something that seems to take artists to a certain place of ancestral memory where creativity and inspiration finds its origins.
The muses represent, I guess you would say, the urge to perform. It's not accidental that our word music comes directly from musike, which is what the muses do. And it's not just playing or singing. It is acting, it's composing history. It's a realm of performance arts, if we like. The genealogy of the muses is important mythically. Their mother, you remember, is named Mozune, which means memory, and their father is Zeus. They spread the word of how the reality of the gods is most important. They really are good daughters of Zeus, but they're also daughters of memory, and every one of these performance arts is a matter of bringing back to life something that was experienced in a culture where you didn't have writing. That's the other important thing. Until around 700 BC, writing was not commonly used at all. And so whatever you had was in memory. You couldn't go to a library and look stuff up. When you start, you know, singing an epic poem like the poems of Homer, you call on the muses. It's like you're tapping into the cloud. In modern data terms, they've got all of that data in their heads, and you beseech them to tell you the story as well.
There's something that we could call your voice, or you could call it the gift, or you could call it talent. I mean, there's something there that's mysterious, or a personal gift of some mysterious kind. Or it could be the muse, is what people used to think it was. That you were visited actually by a muse, and she inspired you and made it happen. We don't think about the muse anymore, but maybe it's a muse.
So René, plain and simple, have you ever been visited by a muse?
Interesting. So I never thought about it, and I would say not really. I mean, for me, where I get my inspiration from. Yeah. But it's so different. So every day is for me an inspiration, and every single person, especially humans, which are different, are a big inspiration for me.
But do you have any moment where you're like alone and then you sort of have this urge to say, this is what I have to do? And then it's just like acting on, as Professor Richard Martin said, tapping on that cloud now in the computer. And then you go as if somebody would be dictating you what to do. And if you don't do it in the moment, this voice is gone.
This, I would say I have the whole time. I mean, I have the whole, yeah. You don't want to look in my brain. Sometimes my staff says that they want to have an insight in my brain what's going on there, but I tell them, no, you don't want that, because actually the whole time something going on, I have the whole time ideas and some creative processes going on, but I cannot follow all these. And then sometimes there is something I think, oh yeah, that's a good idea, I need to think about that, but then it goes away and the next is coming. Yeah. So this happens, I would say, the whole time.
In this dance of cognitive reflection, decision-making, as you mentioned, and prioritizing, and more important, following your sensitivity, your intuition and gut feeling, trusting yourself to jump for something new, as we were saying, with a new menu or so on, it's not always easy. It's not always easy to let go of something that it's already working. Let's hear another question left for you by another guest in this season. This is 3 Michelin star chef Eric Vilgaard, and he asks you.
Hello, my name is Eric Vilgaard, and I would like to ask Chef René Franck, how does cognitive perception work towards a dining experience, particularly in terms of how our gut feeling or instincts connect emotions to a meal, and how could we get better towards using this as a tool in fine dining?
Like we said before, food is something very emotional and definitely also something very intimate. I think a very important thing, especially in fine dining, where also you go to a restaurant and it's about spending money, trust is a big thing. And I think it's very important that you get the trust of your guests, that they trust you and they like you and they want to experience your concept. In my case, with the dessert, if you had like bad experiences with eating dessert or too much sugar, you don't trust eating desserts. And this is also what might to avoid somebody who comes to my restaurant, because they're like, no, I don't want to eat a full dinner with desserts because it's too much sugar. So I need to get the trust of them, that they're not scared to have this experience with me.
So we have been talking about the gut and to follow through your dream and your idea and the dedication. You mentioned the Japanese dedication and to be able to see it become true. And I would like to get back to Ratatouille, the movie, and to Anton Ego, this feared restaurant critic. And in his last review, he also says, I quote, "In many ways, the work of a critic is easy. We risk very little, yet enjoy a position over those who offer up their work and their selves to our judgment. We thrive on negative criticism, which is fun to write and to read. But the bitter truth we critics must face is that in the grand scheme of things, the average piece of junk is probably more meaningful than our criticism designating it so. But there are times when a critic truly risks something, and that is in the discovery and defense of the new. The world is often unkind to new talent, new creations. The new needs friends." So how important are reviews for you? Have you feared bad criticism before opening your innovative concept, Coda? And do you check likes and reviews of your guests?
So if you open a dessert restaurant, you can imagine that critic is like a big thing from the first day on. And I remember when I told my friends, my family that I'm going to open up a dessert bar. Was it that time the concept that it was not that everybody said like, yeah, it's a great idea, do that, that's what we need, yeah. I hear like, you know, who needs a dessert bar? Why don't you make a proper restaurant? And really like everybody said like, nobody needs a dessert bar. And a lot of people said, yeah, we're going to give Coda 6 months, then you're going to close there. And of course, after 8 years, we're more settled and we know what we're doing. And I think reviews and feedback is very important. Sadly, it's like this, that if somebody leaves a negative review somewhere, gets more attention than somebody who leaves a positive review, which is just like, you almost forget it. This person who leaves a positive review, yeah, you smile about it, you're happy, but this person doesn't get enough attention. But for us, it was very important to grow this concept by getting criticized in a positive way and also in a negative way. But it's also, guests made this experience that they couldn't know what's happening in the restaurant to them. And it's also kind of a criticism that they think it's amazing, but I don't understand it and I don't know what's happening. But this is a very important thing for me. And I also criticize my stuff. I like to get criticized, which is always tough, but this is something what brings us forward. It's just like, of course, it's very hard to deal with critic, but especially if you do something that different, what we do at Coda, it's very important to get the feedback and also to get criticized.
And also, I think how you've been explaining things, that nothing is definite, that you continue to evolve and also to optimize things and to learn about the process and your belief in what you're doing. So it's kind of having that voice of the muse, follow that, but get better at it also. Mm-hmm. No? And I think really it takes a lot of guts and drive to come up with a concept such as Coda. And of course, you also need to be very, very bold and skillful and creative to execute it flawless the way you do.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
And you were talking about comparing Munich and Berlin. And that reminded me the other day, like I've heard a political discourse, and I'm not going into politics, but they were talking about an homogeneous culture in Germany. And that's what something that popped up in my mind. I said, homogeneous, what are you talking about? I mean, you just need to go to, I don't know, Munich and then Dresden, and then you'll get a good picture on how Germany has so many faces and it's such a multi-layered culture. I mean, historically, did you already say in a little bit, why did you choose Berlin to open Coda? Please talk about Berlin and what has this city given or taken away from you in the process of developing Coda?
The most important thing for me, what is Berlin about, is freedom and the feeling of freedom. In Berlin, you can be who you want to be. You can do what you want to do. Berlin is diverse. And what shaped Coda to the restaurant, what is today, it's not just me or like Germans. It's like the multicultural inhabitants in Berlin, and the guests, they come to Berlin because they want to experience Berlin as a city, and they see such a interesting and different restaurant concept, and then they say, oh wow, when we're in Berlin, then we need to go to Coda because this is something we haven't seen before and that doesn't exist somewhere else. Because I'm from the south of Germany, and for me was Berlin was always like not Germany here. And I worked before 4 years abroad, and I thought like, if I go back to Germany, then I need to go to Berlin. In between, I went 8 years, no, 6 years to Osnabrück before finally I made it to Berlin. But I knew that Coda needs to be in Berlin. Yeah.
And this freedom is also so fiercely defended by the city itself. It's like the city would have its in spirit of its own and said, don't you dare come here to censor this freedom. I think the history now in this city, it has cost so much to be able to make this statement that freedom is for real.
Yeah, Berlin was always a different city. So to move on, Ceci was talking about her wonderful experience at your restaurant Coda and its great atmosphere. When spending like a serious amount on a night out in a star restaurant, for me personally, the entourage should feel warm and welcoming and social to have a great experience, not being a foodie or a pro. So how would you value the atmosphere in relation to the dining?
So we're definitely not a typical two Michelin star restaurant. This is also not our selling point that we say we are a two Michelin star restaurant. If you really want to have a high-end two Michelin star experience, maybe then you go more to classic restaurants, every Michelin star restaurant gets a plaque where you says like you have like two Michelin stars or three, and we put it in the kitchen. So this is something later on when we guide you through the restaurant and in the kitchen, and we show you how we make our chocolate in the kitchen, then you see the sign. But before, not, and because for us that's not important for the experience that the two Michelin stars are. And the thing is that we want to be very close with the guest. There's not a big distance between the next table where you're sitting, and there's like no distance also to our staff.
Yeah. And it feels actually really like the kitchen at home.
Yes,
it's
yes,
very
yeah,
cozy.
Yeah. We also don't, it's also very small, the whole space. I mean, we have 100 square meter, which is like 50 guest room and 50 kitchen. Compared to the guest room, it's a big kitchen, but we also need that space.
I can imagine, And I found it really interesting that your co-founder, partner of Coda, is an interior designer. And like, I think the outside of the restaurant is for me kind of mysterious because you don't really see it from the street. That's an interesting given. And the atmosphere of the space, the room temperature, the light, the acoustics, everything that stimulates your senses adds to the ultimate dining experience. And can you explain the concept of the space and vision you had to create the best mix for all these senses?
This is, I mean, it was especially about the passion. We were very, very passionate when we opened Coda without actually knowing exactly what we're going to do. We just wanted to create a space where you also feel like challenged because you go there because it's something different. Also, just like when you're outside of the restaurant, there's like graffiti on the wall, there's no sign, there is a doorbell. You even miss the door if you don't know it where it is. Inside, it just shouldn't look like a dessert place. So we always like to play with this kind of a surprise that you really get out of your comfort zone when you go through the door. But you see that inside it's a settled place. There's like it is that like get like a warm welcome, and you immediately feel like you're at home. And we wanted to create this kind of homey living room atmosphere, also with the lighting, which is like spot on what is important. And all the other parts, like the corridor where you walk or the walls, are not important. And the food is highlighted.
I need to go there.
You too.
Chef seems highly complex to me and very demanding. And it starts, of course, with the passion and the dedication, as you said. But a chef cannot build a restaurant on just passion and dedication. You need to be an entrepreneur, a leader, people manager. You need to be creative, extremely disciplined, I think. You need really a good set of skills. And stress resistant, I think that's also a very important thing, and strong and fit. And also maybe a bit stubborn. So how would you describe your personal mix of traits and skills that led you to your current standing? And how do you handle stressful situations in the kitchen?
So as a chef, it depends if you run your own business, your own restaurant. And as you said, you need to be an entrepreneur, you need to be a psychologist. You need to do actually all the things but cooking. This is also for me, I love taking care about the wines also we have in the restaurant. I love taking care about the drinks. And this is for me also kind of the something which gives me energy, just like also, I mean, you always work a lot if you have your own business. And this is also what I do. So I also like to take care of the drink part, which is kind of a different thing for me. And going outside, doing something, where I get a free mind. It's not just like, for example, if I go outside and do some sports and go running, then I think more about my work. But I also love to do like boxing, especially the Muay Thai boxing, where I really can forget everything and I'm focused on what I'm doing. And that's for me very important, doing things where I can forget my work, which is very difficult because 24 hours a day, even when I'm sleeping, I think about my work and about cooking in a very positive way because I'm the whole time driven by ideas and things how I can improve my creativity. So the most important thing is for me to get energy is to do things, especially sport or travel somewhere where I can forget the creative process, which is very important.
Just like, the muse. To silence the muse.
to have a little gap in the day and to not think about it.
And so we're heading to the end of our interview. And René, we started with memories, and why not also close with recollections? So talking about inspiration and the power of imagination, we prepared a fun game for you, René, and we will ask you to close your eyes and travel into your memories. We will name a place or just say a word and ask you to choose 1 to 3 words, if possible, to describe what that word or place reminds you of. Are you ready? Okay. So we're going to start with Helsinki.
Of course, a reindeer and going to the limits.
Zirbelstube in Stuttgart.
Confidence.
Sugar.
Hate love.
Friends.
It's like a trust.
Oriol Balaguer in Barcelona.
Oh, chocolate. Love chocolate.
Allgäu.
I never really lived there, but definitely Lederhosen. Yeah. I was born in Allgäu. I found a picture of me as a young kid wearing the Lederhosen, and this was from the time in Allgäu.
Akelare in San Sebastian.
Thinking outside of the box.
Napa Valley.
Oh, a lot of wine and Meyer lemons. Yeah.
Prometheus.
Inspiration and energy.
Fire.
Energy and definitely cooking.
Georges Blanc.
Oh, this is definitely brown butter, caramel, and actually a lot of foie gras.
Kitchen.
Family and excitement.
Family.
Family is close relation and warm.
And the last one, Kikunoi, Japan.
16 hours a day. And umami.
Chef René Frank, it has been a pleasure having you in the show. And I personally want to thank you for giving us back the joy to enjoy dessert without feeling guilty.
You.
Your kitchen is a revolution, an explosion of creativity, and a source of inspiration that produces not only exquisite food, but also brings a lot of joy. Thanks for sharing your time with us. This interview has been sweet and has been a blast. And thank you, Petra, for coming all the way from Amsterdam. This episode was amazing and it was great to co-host with you.
Thank you. It was a great honor. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
Thank you, René, for your inspiration story and your time. And I learned a lot. And thank you, Ceci, for having me again. It was a pleasure to co-host.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. If you appreciate innovative cuisine and are an adventurous food lover, you need to experience the 2-Michelin-starred restaurant Coda in Berlin. It offers a truly exceptional and unique dining experience. And also, if you want to follow Chef René Frank's steps, visit his webpage at rene-frank.com and coda-berlin.com, or connect with him on social media. All links are, of course, available in this episode's description. Thank you, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. You don't know.